From New York Public Radio, this is On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, the Iraqi government arrested three people it says are implicated in the creation of a cell phone video of Saddam Hussein's execution. Meanwhile, millions across the world went online to watch that grainy footage. It shows guards shouting the name of radical Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. The heckling only added fuel to the sectarian strife plaguing Iraq. So did the timing. While both Sunni and Shia celebrate the Muslim holiday Eid al-Adha, for Shiites it started Sunday. For Sunnis, it started Saturday, the day Saddam was executed. And Saddam was Sunni. Mark Lynch follows the Arab media, and he says this apparent sign of disrespect towards the Sunnis is dominating the region's coverage.
And it really turned any possibility of there actually being a debate about what Saddam Hussein had done to the country, or whether the trial had been fair, or what it was going to do to Iraq. All of those things got swept away by just really almost universal outrage over the timing.
The festival of the Eid commemorates Abraham's willingness to sacrifice his son Isaac. It's the Feast of Sacrifice, which carries no small amount of irony in this case, no?
Well, it goes beyond irony, because one of the things that the Iraqi insurgency and Saddam himself have been trying to do for the last year or so has been to build a whole narrative of Saddam's martyrdom. And what the timing actually does is to give a really powerful boost to that particular narrative. So in a sense, it goes beyond irony and actually gets to something which is very politically dangerous.
Was there any consensus in the media about what Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki was thinking in scheduling the execution for this particular day?
They had to know what the response was going to be. There's a general consensus that it was intentional. What that intent was is very much debated.
And who's getting the blame for the timing here?
The dominant belief is that it has to be an American decision. But the hostility to the Americans goes right up against the growing sectarian hostility. And that's where the cell phone video has been particularly devastating, which really made it look like a sectarian lynching rather than any kind of execution after a trial.
Can you discern a difference in the coverage among the various pan-Arab satellite channels, whether Al Jazeera or Al Arabiya?
Initially, there was, a pretty clear distinction. Before the execution, when it became clear that it was going to happen soon, I saw that the Al Arabiya coverage, and that's the Saudi-owned station, and one which tends to be more pro-American in its coverage, it was covering the story very heavily, I would say more heavily than Al Jazeera was. And it was, I think, trying to portray it as generally a positive thing, whereas Al Jazeera was covering it in a very somber way. They weren't trying to whip up a frenzy over it, but there was this palpable air of melancholy. But then when it happened on the Eid, you saw a convergence pretty quickly, and you saw the pro-Saudi press and also Al Arabiya pretty much agreed with the Al Jazeera and the more Arab nationalist types that this was deliberately offensive to the Sunnis, that it was a disaster.
On your blog on Tuesday, you wrote about an episode of the Al Jazeera program, The Opposite Direction, featuring guests with polar opposite views. Tell me about that episode.
This one was something special. They had one Sunni guest and one Shia guest, and it started off relatively calmly with the Shia guest who was defending the execution. He got to speak first, and he talked about how Saddam was not a victim, not a martyr. He was a mass murderer. And then the Sunni guest accused the Shia of being an Iranian, and it went downhill from there. They almost came to physical blows. The Shia guest stormed out of the studio and left an empty chair for a good 10 minutes until he eventually was persuaded to come back. And there was a lot of really, really intense sectarian venom being unleashed. And to see it so nakedly and so intensely on what is probably the most popular political television show in the Middle East, it was really pretty sensational.
On Monday, the Iraqi government closed down the Baghdad office of Al-Sharqiya, which is a Dubai-based satellite channel. Their charge was that the station was inciting sectarianism in its coverage of the execution. Now, this is a Sunni sympathetic channel, but I'm curious, in terms of promoting sectarian violence, is there more danger of a Sunni station telling Sunnis, you know, what they expect to hear, or from something like The Opposite Direction, which was, you know, sort of explicitly incendiary, seeming almost to be designed to incite more Shia-Sunni violence?
The Iraqi media overall, it has become increasingly sectarian, and you're getting to a situation where a lot of the communities tend to only watch their own media, and it helps to fuel the conflict. The Opposite Direction and just Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya in general, because they're broadcasting from abroad, they actually do reach across the communities. So in a sense, they almost become a substitute for a genuinely national media, and at least gives the chance to have a dialogue. I wouldn't say that the Opposite Direction program was inciting violence so much as giving voice to these real intense sectarian angers and fears and hatreds that have been unleashed by the last few years of violence. So in a sense, it's an honest reflection of what people are actually saying. Whether it's better to have that kind of raw, passionate argument on TV or to keep it off the air, I think that's a really tough question.
Well, Mark, as always, thank you very much.
Well, thanks for having me.
Mark Lynch teaches political science at Williams College. You can read his ongoing analysis of Arab media at abuardvark.com. If the Saddam video widened the sectarian gulf in Iraq, here in the U.S., there's been something closer to consensus among those who watched it. On Tuesday, Tom Brokaw articulated the queasiness of many during a call to the Imus in the Morning radio show.
To say that we're going to install in Iraq a judicial system and have something that resembled the worst kind of nightmare out of the old American West. Saddam Hussein suddenly becomes a martyr.
Saddam is hardly the first prisoner to die a mass-mediated death. In the 19th century, the execution of Mexican Emperor Maximilian of Habsburg was painted by Edouard Manet. But it was photography that really brought official executions to life, so to speak, as in 1865 when John Wilkes Booth's collaborators were hanged. After World War II, photos were snapped at the hanging of Nazis at Nuremberg and Japanese war criminals at Sugamo Prison. And video came along just in time to catch the execution of Romanian strongman Nicolae Ceaușescu. In the Wall Street Journal on Thursday, art critic Richard Woodward wrote that these images are hugely influential in shaping the legacies of those executed. And so he's troubled by the Saddam video in just about every way but one.
I think the primary benefit is that there will not now be a conspiracy theory that Saddam is coming back. Hitler committed suicide, and his body was hidden for years and years, and the pictures were not seen. That allowed all kinds of rumors to float around for years that he was still alive and coming back. So it certainly puts an end, I think, to that idea. But I think that exhausts the benefits of the way it was done.
The video that we saw on the internet was shot with a cell phone and therefore fairly grainy and jumpy. Does that affect how we perceive the event itself?
Oh, very much so. I think the way the Lincoln co-conspirators were photographed and the way the Nuremberg and the Sugamo prison Japanese war criminals were photographed was done with a measure of dignity. And this has the skeeviness of an underground violent porn film. That aspect contributes to its unseemliness.
It's supposed to look like rule of law. In the end, it just comes out as hooliganism.
Exactly. And he's actually has a stoic appearance and actually appears more dignified than his executors. There have been a number of snuff films and executions during the last 5 or 6 years, from the Daniel Pearl video to the Nicholas Berg video, which I myself cannot watch because they're so gruesome and the people being killed are relatively powerless. But Saddam was a monster. And it's sad that the people who killed him, and there's certainly plenty of evidence that he deserved to die, but they have handed him this platform to go out with a certain amount of style, if that's not too grotesque a word.
You saw this video, me too, although like you, I've intentionally avoided all the previous video gruesomeness from Iraq and elsewhere. Now, I don't believe in capital punishment, yet I scarcely hesitated to see Saddam Hussein being hanged. And at least a million others behaved the same way on YouTube alone. Any thoughts as to why?
Well, I was shocked to learn that many people watched the Daniel Pearl video or watched the Nicholas Berg video out of curiosity and in some ways to steel themselves or to become enraged. There are any number of reasons why we look at something and why we have a voyeuristic interest in it. I share with you that feeling that I didn't hesitate so much because it was of historic importance, just as I didn't really hesitate to look at pictures of the Ceausescu's dead or Mussolini dead. I felt a certain measure of relief. That was dissipated or destroyed by the way it was done and by the repercussions that I think will follow from this.
Well, then, if this was a botched job, if it was too much of a snuff film for comfort, in your view, how would the video documentation of the execution of a convicted tyrant been done?
Well, I'm certainly not an expert on how one should dispatch of a tyrant, but I think even to have done it in a clean, lighted place rather than in a sort of dungeon would have contributed to the dignity of the occasion. As it is, it looks like a basement tape.
So what it needed was better production values.
Well, in some way you could say that.
Richard, thank you very much.
Thank you. I enjoyed being here.
Richard B. Woodward is a New York arts critic. His piece, Subtext Message, the Cell Phone Video of Saddam's Execution, appeared in the Wall Street Journal.
This is On the Media from NPR. If you can hear me right now, then you're listening to the podcast. And since you listen on your own schedule, you might like our newsletter because it gives a quick summary of what we're covering each week. You can sign up at onthemedia.org. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield with a few of your letters. On the replay of our radio theater piece, Pledge This, Arthur Charles said he, quote, loved the parody, was in tears for at least 20 minutes. On the other hand, Jeff Overwright said he, quote, couldn't take it. Maybe some listeners found it an absolute scream, but to me it was like spending the day at someone else's family reunion. Boring.
On Bob's commentary about the media's preoccupation with the climbers on Mount Hood, Abigail Hastings wrote that she came to a different conclusion, quote, "The thought of people risking their lives to save others calls forth in us more than idle titillation, as many diversionary stories might. More likely, we are on a hunt for something that looks like hope and triumph in a hopeless situation. Now, wouldn't that resonate for a war-weary world?"
Bob Campin wrote in with this comment about Brooks' piece on atheism in the media, quote, "You do realize that in quoting Colbert's use of the term godless sodomites at the end of your piece on the new atheists, you are indeed quoting a satirist who teaches Sunday school at a congregational church."
Actually, we did realize that, but Colbert's joke was relevant not as a defense of atheism, but as a criticism of a Hollywood stereotype. Thanks for the comments. Keep them coming in to onthemedia@wnyc.org. And don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name.
For the first show of the new year, we thought we'd address the future of the computer, what it can't do, what it can do, what it's about to be able to do.
On the matter of what it can't do, we turn to Tim Wu, co-author with Jack Goldsmith of Who Controls the Internet. What he found is that the computer, or rather the Internet it spawned, cannot be an oasis of freedom without borders or rulers or hardly any rules. President Clinton joked in 1998 that China's effort to control the Internet was like trying to nail Jell-O to the wall. But it turns out that Jell-O is nailable if you have the will, the technology, and the law behind you. And nations have all three, especially laws governing everything from copyright to privacy to speech. Then there are the laws of the marketplace, which may be the most powerful of all. Tim Wu joins us now. Tim, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So after studying the question, who controls the Internet, you saw time and time again that mostly it's governments, and it's governments with competing ideologies. Could you explain, first of all, how that works and what these competing ideologies are?
Sure. If you look at the history of the Internet, one government, especially the American government, has an enormous role in shaping the nature and the ideology of the network. It is built to be free. It is built to be decentralized. It is built to be an engine of information transmission. And what I think has changed over the last 10 years is that other countries have begun to get into this game and say that they want a say in what the Internet looks like. And they've used the powers that governments have to try and make the Internet more in their image than simply the American image.
And the American ideology that governed the net was essentially a celebration of free markets and free speech.
And that was supported by the American government and the American Defense Department in particular. And what we chronicle in this book is the efforts by other nations to fight that ideology with their own ideas of how things should be regulated.
France was able to rule that Yahoo couldn't sell Nazi memorabilia in France. China can use American technology, principally, to pursue and jail dissidents online.
Let me talk about Yahoo, because that was a big turning point.
Mm-hmm.
Yahoo was sued in France by a French plaintiff for selling or for being possible to buy Nazi goods from the Yahoo auction site in France. And Yahoo really thought there was no way some court in France was going to tell them what to do. You know, so they fought the lawsuit. They dismissed it. They just basically ignored it until finally the French judge ruled that they had violated French law and began threatening Yahoo with really serious fines and possible imprisonment of Yahoo executives if they came anywhere close to France. And suddenly Yahoo rolled over. And that was a real turning point in the history of the Internet. And then, you know, things went further. Not only did Yahoo then agree to everything that France said, although they claimed not to be, eventually Yahoo, the once agent of free speech, became an agent of thought control for the Chinese government when they began, you know, collecting emails and reporting on dissident activities of their users on behalf of the Chinese government, eventually leading to at least one dissident being thrown in jail for 10 years for leaking a memo on a Yahoo email account. And so, you know, in that story of Yahoo and its transition is really the story of how the Internet's changed over the last 10 or 15 years.
one sentence in your book that really stood out for me was your observation that the question used to be, how will the internet affect China? And now the question is, how will China affect the internet?
I think that's exactly right. They are leading the way in trying to make the internet much more centralized and much more controllable, something that you can sit in one office and see what's going on and decide what people can and can't see. I don't intentionally mean to link these two parties in the United States, but the Bell companies and the cable companies, but more Bell, have been fighting also to have a more controlled internet. They say it'll be safer. There is a big picture ideological battle going on right now, and it's a big battle between a centralized ideology and a decentralized ideology. And it is being fought out every day and every time you click on something.
You don't come down on the position that government interference is always bad. In your book, you say it's not only inevitable, it's frequently very, very good.
There's a general reaction that government's internet bad. But you have to ask in the future, you know, if this medium is so important, how do we decide what it's going to be like? People in Germany, for example, or in France, I think, have a right, if they feel like it, to say that we don't want Nazi material sold or displayed on our nets. They have these rights as sovereign nations. Now, it doesn't agree with the First Amendment of the United States Constitution, but that is the United States Constitution. So to the degree that we think that governments represent people, it makes sense to me that governments should have the right to have some say over what this network looks like. Governments do very bad things, but, you know, they also, for basic security and basic functioning of a nation, they're pretty important. And even, you know, libertarians admit that. And if you look at any business, at some degree, they're dependent on property rights. They're dependent on a basic secure environment. They need a financial system. All of these are things where you need some type of government.
And eBay is a perfect example of that.
Yeah, eBay is a great story. I mean, eBay was founded on the idea that you can trust people and, you know, they will do the right thing and they will pay up their debts. And generally speaking, that has been true. The feedback system on eBay works most of the time. But there are some people who are just not interested. They're there to cheat the system, steal money, and make off with whatever they can make off with. And what eBay found slowly is that its system was not working, and it had to go into direct cooperation with the FBI, with California State Police, and try to, as much as it can, catch frauders, arrest them, have them put in jail, and threaten anyone who does this. Right now, I think it has employed over 800 former law enforcement officials who spend their time trying to catch frauders and, you know, and cooperate with the FBI to put them in jail.
800 people, some who had investigated organized crime in their previous life for the FBI. And this was a company that started with a nice guy called Uncle Griff in Vermont, who would personally adjudicate disputes among well-intended parties. Suddenly, you have an entire police force, almost like Interpol.
Right. I mean, eBay is just a perfect example of sort of what you need to do to make utopia work.
Tim, thanks a lot.
I enjoyed it. Thanks.
Tim Wu is the author, with Jack Goldsmith, of Who Controls the Internet?
Despite the strenuous efforts of nations, the world is growing ever more interconnected. But that doesn't much matter if your connection is slow. You can't run an efficient business on a bad connection, and it's increasingly clear you can't run an efficient city on one either, not to mention educate students or support economic growth. That's why some 300 American municipalities are looking to offer wireless service, or Wi-Fi, everywhere, from a cramped studio apartment to a secluded park bench. But what kind of Wi-Fi? OTM's Mark Phillips offers a few real-life models, public, private, and one that's a little bit of both.
Whole cities covered with a wireless internet network, giving free access to everyone, anywhere, for free. It seems like a utopian vision. Is free citywide wireless really possible?
I've always been able to log on. I've always had success keeping a steady signal. It's worked really well for me, and the people that I've talked to, it's worked really, really well for them, too.
Heather Painter lives in St. Cloud, Florida, a small town outside of Orlando. The municipal government spent just under $3 million to build a Wi-Fi network to cover the 15-square-mile town. Accessing the internet is free anywhere in the city limits. The network was partially funded by tax dollars, but the free Wi-Fi ends up saving most residents money by eliminating their monthly internet bill. Howard DeYoung is St. Cloud's IT director.
It benefits us from an economic development point locally. You know, instead of paying large telecom companies $500 to $600 a year when that money leave the area, now a resident has $500 to $600 a year that they can spend locally.
Residents save, but so does the city. In Corpus Christi, Texas, the Wi-Fi network is used regularly in dozens of ways by municipal employees, 70% of whom work in the field. Gas, water, and electric meters in Corpus Christi are now automated so that each day they turn themselves on and send a reading over the wireless network. Leonard Scott works for Corpus Christi's IT department.
We started out with about 25 meter readers, and at the end of the meter deployment, we'll be down to about four key individuals. So the wireless system pays for itself. It eliminates costs, avoids costs, and reduces costs.
With everyone seemingly saving on the deal, building a public network should be a no-brainer. But not to Don Berryman, executive vice president of Earthlink, a big internet service provider.
You got to think of the cost of the back end of that model. Somebody has to pay for it. So it would be then shared among all of the taxpayers in the community, whether you wanted to use it or not. And so there would be an unfair advantage for those people who actually used it.
The residents of St. Cloud haven't complained, and in fact, three quarters of them opened accounts within 6 months of the free network's launch. Still, Philadelphia decided to go a different way and hired Earthlink to build a citywide private network. Not only is that more fair, says Earthlink's Berryman, but there are other good reasons why cities shouldn't build their own Wi-Fi.
We don't necessarily think local governments ought to go out and build these networks, one, because they don't have the expertise, and two, they don't have the infrastructure to run them once they're built.
To declare that cities don't have the know-how is utterly ridiculous.
Sasha Meinrath is the co-founder of the Champaign-Urbana Community Wireless Network.
Cities run police departments. They run fire departments. They respond to anyone and everyone who calls incredibly quickly. So they run incredibly complicated, incredibly critical resources all across the country, and they do it well.
Greg Goldman is the head of Philadelphia Wireless, a nonprofit working with Earthlink and the city to launch the network. He says Philadelphia probably could have managed it logistically, but that the city couldn't hack it politically.
I just don't think it was a political and economic possibility in real terms. You know, we have a major corporate player in Philadelphia, Comcast, which is very much involved in this market.
Comcast is one of Philadelphia's biggest internet service providers, or ISPs, the businesses we pay each month for internet access. We pay them, and they pay whoever owns the cable or phone lines they use. But Comcast also owns the cable lines, so it makes money in two ways. Off the ISPs that use their cable, and every customer who subscribes to its service directly. Meanwhile, Verizon owns Philadelphia's telephone lines, so they get paid by ISPs too. Needless to say, neither Comcast nor Verizon are thrilled about Earthlink eliminating the need for wires altogether. That's a payday they'll lose to Earthlink. Greg Goldman.
Those folks are not happy about the model that we've created, which is a for-pay model. I can only imagine how much more unhappy they would be if all of a sudden people give it away for free. Plus, it would have had to have required a major investment from the taxpayers of the city. And so, from a political perspective, I don't see the possibility of how it actually could have been offered for free.
Verizon and Comcast waged serious lobbying efforts to block any Wi-Fi plan that was even indirectly public, and eventually the city turned to Earthlink to build the network. Earthlink, of course, is thrilled to have a network of their own, bypassing Comcast cable lines, and is now pursuing similar projects in dozens of cities. But advocates of publicly owned wireless don't believe Earthlink can solve the twin problems of limited access and high prices. After all, Earthlink's for-profit network does come with a price tag to residents. Wi-Fi service will cost $22 a month. But the company says it aims to be a more compassionate pipeline. If you earn less than $13,000 a year in Philadelphia, you're eligible for a reduced rate. Berryman from Earthlink.
It's in Philadelphia $9.95 a month for a low-income household. So that's pretty inexpensive. That's less than a cost of McDonald's for the day. And so you have internet access, high-speed internet access, for the people who currently don't have access.
About a third of Earthlink's Wi-Fi customers will be eligible for that discount, and the company plans to assist even those with bad credit in opening accounts. Plus, Wireless Philadelphia is looking into providing computers and computer training to low-income families. Other cities are also looking to bridge the digital divide.
We have in Boston 60% of the households and close to 80% of the Boston public school children don't have internet access at home.
Pamela Reeve was a member of the Boston Wireless Task Force charged with finding a solution in Beantown. The task force wasn't sold on Philadelphia's private model.
There were some cases where cities have granted one private entity the right to build and manage a network, and we were concerned that would not give us the kind of openness and the kind of competitive environment for products and services that we felt was going to be really important.
But the Boston Task Force also saw problems in a model that was entirely public.
Purely public model, which relies on tax resources or the focus of any given administration, didn't seem to be the way to go. So that's why we decided to create a separate nonprofit organization.
That separate nonprofit organization will raise the money to build the network and will therefore own it. But it won't act as the ISP. The Boston nonprofit will let ISPs use their network at very low rates. So low, in fact, that even small local services can jump in. Reeve says Bostonians will still have to pay for the service, but about half as much as Philadelphians pay, around $10 or $15 per month. And with lots of little ISPs competing in the same market, there'll be plenty of room to experiment with pricing.
If someone wants to buy bits from us and turn around and offer them for free to their users, maybe an ad-based model, something like that, that's fine. If they want to sell them on a subscription basis, we don't really care. We're going to sell wholesale to any and all ISPs that will jump on this network.
Boston's model is much closer to how internet service is provided in Europe.
In the UK, by regulation, there is a separation between the network providers and the service providers, the ISPs. And in that country, there are 15 to 25 ISPs in any given location.
The dozens of ISP options in European cities have led to much lower prices for much faster service than what's offered in the U.S. And after leading the world in internet access and affordability, the U.S. is quickly falling behind.
We're 21st, right behind Estonia.
FCC Commissioner Michael Copps.
Other countries are cleaning our clock and getting a lot of bandwidth out to their folks at a cheap price. We know that we're not in the competition. Other countries are not going to wait for that kid in rural America to catch up.
These new wireless networks offer a chance to catch up, but it also presents another chance to mess up. Cautious municipal governments are reluctant to embark on bold public projects, but once they choose and build the network, residents could be stuck with it indefinitely. If cities choose incorrectly or stick to the status quo, they'll miss out on not just a utopian wireless future, but also the benefits of the technological wave currently sweeping past our shores. For On the Media, I'm Mark Phillips.
Coming up, the increasing ability of computers to shop for you, think for you, and remember for you.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, featuring a new book by Carl Schramm, The Entrepreneurial Imperative, at kauffman.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, exploring how technology is changing kids and learning, at digitallearning.macfound.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. For a couple years now, we've been living in a Web 2.0 world. Web 2.0 is the nickname given to the second generation of the web, in which the static pages of the early internet gave way to something more fluid, where users can more easily find and share information, music, and video. We were just settling into Web 2.0 when suddenly, back in November, the New York Times ran a page one story about the future of a new semantic web, a web that thinks. Web 3.0? Huh? Nigel Shadbolt is a professor of artificial intelligence, or AI, at the School of Electronics and Computer Science at Southampton University in England. He says that Web 3.0 will not only give us the facts we seek, it will choose among them, organize them, essentially do our work for us.
So I might ask of Web 3.0, if it was actually there and running at the moment, book me a holiday in Vienna in a nice resort near Innsbruck for my family next week. Oh, and by the way, I've got a 12-year-old. Now, that kind of expression of a complex question is nothing that we can precisely enter into the web as it currently exists. People's hopes and aspirations for this more complete web are that it'll be able to deal with these kinds of complex queries.
Under Web 3.0, you're talking about the computer actually making some judgments for me. How do it know?
Well, when you look at the web page of a holiday provider and look at all of those features on the page, a particular location, particular hotel type, how long it'll take to get there, you are extracting all of that information using your wetware and your eyeballs and 4 billion years of evolution. That's what human beings are exquisitely good at. What we're developing in this next generation of web are markup languages which are able to take the content on pages and documents like that and describe the bits of that content that are about the hotel and its location, about the expected amount of sunshine at a particular month in the year. It's called metadata, and the metadata is now allowing us to have information about the information available. And that's how the machines know. Essentially, one machine will be using a particular vocabulary to describe its markup, and it will go and tell another machine that this is the place to look for to find out how it's using those definitions.
It sounds to me what you're describing is artificial intelligence.
I kind of think of the web as almost like a natural ecology. And what we're seeing start to pop up in various parts of the web are simple sorts of micro-intelligences. Now, this isn't full-blown AI, but in just the way that we now have shopping assistants, shop bots that can go out there and get a good price for us from particular stores, or an auction agent that can sit around and make a bid for us on eBay, these very limited sorts of adaptive behavior are going to start to spring up across the web. So I think of the web starting to illustrate lots of micro-intelligences rather than being some kind of super sentient information fabric. I think that's that really does remain in the realm of science fiction.
In the New York Times, there was a piece about Web 3.0 talking about a system called, forgive me, I don't know the pronunciation, but it's CYC.
Psyche.
Okay.
The Psyche project was an attempt some years ago now to try and use AI techniques to construct encyclopedic knowledge that humans have about the world. Now, one of the very hardest things to get our computers to understand is all the common sense knowledge we have about how the world works and is structured. The fact that if I have a can of water above a cup and I pour the can of water under normal gravity, that water will just flow into the cup. All that common sense knowledge that we have packed in over years of development is hard to reproduce in computers. Now, what Psyche has been about is trying to regiment large amounts of common sense knowledge and put that to work in programs that reason about various aspects of the world. Now, Psyche has been seen as a potential help to Web 3.0. I don't think we're going to be able to kind of plant all of that encyclopedic knowledge into the web and just have good things happen. It's much more likely that we'll take facets and aspects of Psyche's knowledge base and use them for particular tasks.
This is all fascinating. Is there any reason to think that this is going to materialize in the next year, the next 5 years, the next 30 years? How close are we to a Web 3.0 artificial intelligence online world?
I don't see that just around the corner. I think what we'll see is increasing amounts of these limited intelligent services. I also see a web that will be still very much driven by people. People are the real intelligence in the web. And what we see happening in very interesting developments like Wikipedia, where you get this collective wisdom, large numbers of individuals collaborating to reveal and put down their experience, their intelligence. What we see there is this key facet of the web, that people are extremely good at being the general intelligence on the planet. And what the web machines deliver up to us are particular ways of holding vast amounts of detailed information and serving and filtering that information in accurate ways.
Nigel, you're kind to talk with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Nigel Shadbolt is professor of artificial intelligence in the School of Electronics and Computer Science at Southampton University.
Gordon Bell is a 72-year-old computer scientist with an eye for detail. Every detail, in fact, that he's accumulated over the course of his life. A senior researcher for Microsoft, Bell is at the vanguard of a movement called life logging, digitally storing every letter and photo, every phone call, email, and video, every conversation, keystroke, and scrap of paper, the entire minutia of his daily routine, onto a hard drive. He wears a camera around his neck called a sense cam that takes snapshots every minute of whatever may be in his path, including you, if you happen to be standing there. Gordon Bell is creating a complete virtual memory to supplement his own imperfect one, a defiant Proustian reclamation of lost time that may be changing the very way we think about the past. But why?
Why?
Yeah.
Why does anybody ever preserve anything? Is there any value to having a photograph of my mother at age 3 or so, you know, or a deed that I happen to have that would have been around in a shoebox that came from great-grandparents before 1900? So anything that, in fact, represents information, those things are all put in cyberspace, and those are the things that I think should be in cyberspace. I go further than anybody else, which is to essentially really overtly get rid of anything I can that I can scan. And that includes coffee cups and t-shirts and mugs, you know, things like that where I may want a memory of that.
I suspect this isn't for everyone. I mean, some of us really like to get rid of stuff. They feel the burden of all of life's flotsam and jetsam.
Yeah, that's true. But I've got a kind of a systematic way of getting rid of it. But yet it's there if you ever will, in fact, want it.
Gordon, do you see your computer as a real extension of your brain these days?
I think I do. I really do. I think of it as offloading a tremendous amount for me and giving it a lot of responsibility.
Could you go back to life before?
Oh, I think I could go back to life before. It's a different life. Frankly, I think of myself a little bit. I'm in an explorer's life right now. I see it as a quest to have an electronic memory that has so much of one's own real memory in it, because I tend to think that everybody is going to be here, you know, at some point in time.
Lifelogger Gordon Bell. Journalist and technology whiz Clive Thompson wrote about Bell and the implications of lifelogging in Fast Company magazine. Clive, welcome back to the show.
Good to be here.
So what did you expect and what did you find when you went to visit Gordon Bell?
Well, I think I expected that there would be this guy who has, you know, this brain that would give him perfect recall of everything immediately, and I could ask him, who's the person that sat next to you on the plane 3 weeks ago? And, you know, what was the recipe that you cooked 2 years ago for dinner? And that would be this very precise thing, because all the information is there. And it's true, all the information is there, but he hasn't quite figured out how to organize it and sort it perfectly. So although he would sometimes be amazing at recall, like he was talking about a jazz symphony that he saw in Australia, and he's trying to describe it and he realizes he doesn't need to describe it. He can just play it for me, you know? So sometimes it was amazing, but a lot of the times he would start to try and find something and then spend 20 minutes trying to find it. And eventually sort of get lost in this buggy software, because it's a new piece of software. It's a demo.
So it's easy to preserve all this raw data,
yes,
but it's extremely hard to lay your hands on exactly the piece you want at that time. But isn't he developing, or aren't other people developing for him, programs to do that? Life Browser, Remembrance Agent, Facet Map?
You know, that's the holy grail quest right now. Like at Microsoft, they have this thing called Facet Map. It's this beautiful sort of graphical interface where you can zoom down on any one thing and it's connected to everything else. Like you could say, okay, show me last Thursday, and it'll show you all the emails you sent and all the documents you looked at and all the websites you looked at. And then you might go, well, let's look at those websites. And you find a website and it might show you all the other days that you access that website. So you can sort of tunnel through your memories in very interesting sort of dreamy ways.
And is it also Facet Map that uses not just
just days or time periods, but you can also drill down on a person.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Tell me everything about my Aunt Susie that I've stored up.
And that's very useful, because what will happen is you'll think, okay, well, Brooke mentioned this book to me. I can't remember the name of the book. So I'll start by just looking at everything I have that's related to Brooke. And I'll remember that you said that to me, I don't know, a month ago when I was on the show. So I'll look at all the communications I had with you a month ago. And so it actually becomes very quick to find the name of the book because I find the email or the conversation. It works very well that way because that's sort of the way our memories work. Psychologists have long discovered that we organize our memories very often based on people and time. And if you put those two things together, you can index the vast majority of your memories very quickly.
So if you want to be able to find this information, you have to sort of replicate what your memory would naturally do.
Yes, exactly.
And you focus quite a bit on the effect that a surrogate brain has on actual carbon-based memory, our physical minds.
Sure, absolutely. Well, I mean, what Gordon has found is that it's changed the way that he decides to remember things and what he decides to remember. And he compares it to doing long division. He could probably remember how to do long division if he really thought about it, but he doesn't need to because he has pocket calculators. Just think about our behavior with our mobile phones. A lot of people can't remember the phone numbers of their very, very close associates because their phones remember it for them. And they put it in once and they forget it.
Long division we were forced to learn at some point.
That's
so
right.
We have the luxury of forgetting it, but not these phone numbers. Without our cell phones, we're lost.
Right. And actually, in Europe, where their phone is really has thousands of phone numbers and emails because it's their central device, there is a huge anxiety about losing your phone or losing the memory on your phone. They have all these backup devices for like saving all your phone information because they just like emotionally destroyed if they lose their phone because everything was on it. You know, it's like having a stroke. The information is all gone.
Exactly. And actually, you met another life blogger, not Gordon Bell, who actually went through a kind of digital stroke, a crash of his computer.
Yeah, he lost about 4 months.
Who is this?
This is Jim Gemmell, and he is one of the software engineers who works along with Gordon on essentially trying to figure out ways to sift through Gordon's enormous decades of memories. And so Jim decided, you know, as he developed the software, that he would do it himself. He would start doing his own life logging. And he showed me. It's wonderful. He's got some amazing things. Trips he's taken with his kids and some really wonderful stuff that is very emotionally touching. But what happened was that he had a crash and he lost about 4 months of it. And up until then, he had sort of thought, well, this is just this funny little experiment. I'm doing it to sort of learn how to make the software. I don't really rely on this stuff. But once the information was gone, he realized that he did rely on it, that it was like hot water or lights in his house. And then when he lost it, he felt absolutely bereft.
Now, losing that day at the beach you spent back in April, I mean, your brain was still working then, wasn't it? Don't you still have it?
Yeah, theoretically. The workings of human memory are very very complex. Psychologists are as yet uncertain as to what the effect of all this virtual memory will be. Will it really be true that we'll sort of stop remembering things? Or will it release us to remember things in different ways? Or in some cases, will it make our memories better? Because the one thing that some scientists found in Ireland, they took Gordon's camera that he wears around his neck. It takes pictures every minute or so all day long. And, you know, so he's got thousands and thousands and thousands of these pictures. And you think, well, what are you ever going to do with those? You're never going to look at them again, right? What these guys in Ireland discovered was that if at the end of the day, you look at all those pictures, just blah, 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 really quickly scroll through them in about a minute, you relive your day as seen out your eyes, and it dramatically improves your long-term recall of what happened.
And this has been applied to people who are afflicted with short-term memory impairment, right?
That's right. That's right. This has been done with a woman in England who has a very severe form of amnesia. She really has no recall past a day or two. And so what she started doing was that every time there was something that she wanted to remember, a dinner with her husband, perhaps, she would make sure that she wore this camera. And then after the event was over, she would review the images every day for a couple of days. And she started being able to remember this stuff. It would last for months.
And you can really see the value of it in that case.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
I guess I still find puzzling why we need this kind of recall in our everyday life. Unless you believe, as many people do, that really all we are our memories. Are we fuller, more complete people if we can hold on to that stuff?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think that what's going to happen is that people will sort of make decisions about what type of memory they want to have. You might decide that, you know, I'm actually someone who just wants to see that one perfect picture from last summer. the sort of classic shoebox idea, where by the time you're 60, you've got a shoebox full of pictures, and that's all you've got. These little snapshots that represent an entire year in your life, and when you look at it, you recall everything, and it's a really majestic, almost poetic way of looking at your life, and you'll find other people who really want to have everything there. I think some people might choose to record a lot of stuff and then realize later on that, my God, why did I do this? You know, in the same way that some kids are discovering now that all the stuff they put on their websites is being Googled by their employers. So, you know, we'll make decisions about what type of memories we want to have. And in some cases, the decisions will be taken out of our hands. And that's where things get troubling, potentially.
Privacy then becomes a huge issue, doesn't it?
Sure.
There are certain things we'd all rather not remember. If you're engaged with, you know, one or two other people, one of them's bound to have it on tape.
That's right. But I think there's also a sort of a very weird form of privacy when you have this automatic recording capability, which is privacy from yourself. There's parts of your life that maybe you shouldn't remember. And making sense of your life is as much about forgetting the vast majority of it or subtly distorting it as it is perfectly remembering it. Any psychologist would tell you that forgetting is an incredibly important part of how we make sense of ourselves and our lives. And being able to re-experience directly everything might be sort of nightmarish. And the very few times that psychologists have encountered people with absolutely perfect recall, and it has been found, it's very rare, a sort of mental condition where people literally can, if you ask them, 2 years ago on this day, what did you do? They'll be able to tell you. These people do not have remarkable lives in any way. You would think that they're smarter or that they did better at college, and they're not. And they don't necessarily have a better emotional experience of their lives. The idea of remembering everything, it might not be as much of a gift as we think it would be.
Clive, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
Clive Thompson is a contributing writer for Fast Company magazine and others. Go to onthemedia.org if you'd like to listen to the unedited version of this conversation. It's all there as it really happened.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, Mike Volo, and Mark Phillips, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Alicia Rebensdorf and Michael McLaughlin. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at wnyc.org. And thanks.